Hey everyone, welcome to the Grief Informed Podcast. I'm your host, Rachel Garcia, and this is a place where I bring you authentic conversations with people who are willing to share their journey through seasons of grief. No matter your cultural upbringing, societal conditioning, or faith practice, grief affects us all. Whether you're dealing with a loss, a diagnosis, a broken heart, or the everyday stressors of life, or love someone who is, these conversations are here to support you in that process. So be sure to check out the show notes for potential trigger warnings. And whether you're very comfortable with or deeply avoidant of grief and its many responses, you are welcome here. Thank you for being here, and now on to the episode. Hey everybody, welcome back to the Grief Informed Podcast. I'm your host, Rachel Garcia, and I am very grateful that you're here today, and today I have with me Dr. Ricky Barrows, who is a clinical psychologist originally from Leicester, England, now based in Nova Scotia, Canada. In his private practice, he provides psychological therapy and assessment for adults facing a wide range of emotional and psychological challenges. And beyond his work, Ricky is a lifelong explorer of the human psyche, committed to understanding the depths of emotion, healing, and personal growth, both in himself and in those he works with. He believes that navigating grief and other deep emotions can feel overwhelming, but no one has to do it alone. Thank you for being here, Dr. Ricky Barrows. Also, Ricky.
Thank you. Yeah, absolutely. Just call me Ricky. And that's one of the first things I say to people, just please call me Ricky. It's like, it's a very human thing just to be on first name basis with one another.
Yeah. Well, welcome to the podcast. Just so we can get to know you a little bit better, do you know your Enneagram number?
Well, I think I'm a number 5. Yeah, most certainly the curious, intellectual, investigator part of that 5, I can identify with, for sure.
The 5, which lends to the work that you do.
Oh, yeah. You know, there's an alignment there that I'm very thankful to have found, absolutely.
Okay, well, tell us a little bit about your cultural upbringing and background and how it might contribute to what you do today.
Yeah, so like you said, born and raised in Leicester. So Leicester's right in the middle of England. If you put a cross through England, Leicester's literally in the middle there. What elements are the most related to my work? And I suppose my childhood kind of confusion, distress growing up. I was a very anxious child. I had a lot of health concerns and panic attacks that really made my world feel very kind of threatening, really kind of showed it like to be, I wasn't feel very safe to kind of play and be, and spent a lot of time wondering like how I could be okay. And for anyone that suffered a panic attack, you just have this thought that you're dying all the time. And to suffer those for years really kind of put, it made my young self go, how do I work around this? How do I be okay in the world? And my 11-year-old self, even at the time, it had this idea was, how do I die well? Because that's what it felt like again and again and again, having these panic attacks. And I was very much like a number 5, I'm very much an observer. So I was somebody who that was kind of set back from other people, didn't really feel like I belonged. And I was very much an observer of other people. And I didn't really have any labels or names or understanding of what I was seeing, but I knew I was starting to see complex patterns. I didn't quite know what to do with that at the time. And I didn't do very well at school. I didn't really come out with any GCSEs, which is what you call those kind of qualifications in England. So I didn't really have any job prospects. I went into the army, didn't like that, didn't get on with it at all. Ended up needing to do something practical. So I became a bricklayer I actually enjoyed that. That was something I could do very well, but soon found that I was depressed and down and not really fitting in there either. And it was around that time that I came across Stephen Covey's book, 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. And At that stage, I wasn't able to read very well. And so, but I really wanted to read that book for some reason. There's something that drew me towards that. And he became like a guiding father, he did, in that book. So the words, the concepts, just this, even this idea of perception, even the idea that people thought about thinking in terms of philosophy and psychology, just absolutely lit me up and gave my kind of younger self a direction. And basically, you know, not having any formal qualifications, it was a bit of a struggle, but I managed to get myself into doing psychology. Didn't even know I wanted to do clinical psychology, actually. Just wanted to learn more about people, and then managed to find my way through into clinical psychology, working with adults. And undergraduate and doctorate training have actually really, really different. Like, psychology in itself is very statistical, biological, like it's quite, I don't know, it's factual. And then when you get into the clinical training, it's very personal. And I just found my place very, very well there. Yeah, and I found my niche because clinical psychology is so big. You can do so many different things with it. You can go into neurology, you can go into children, learning disability, older adults, like, you know, even with adults, there's different, like, different kind of areas you can go in. Like, you can specialize in eating disorders or schizophrenia. I choose to be more broad and work with the general adult mental health, with a particular focus on somatic disorders. So, like, emotional, like, physical health problems caused by emotional processes. That's what actually brought me to Canada in the first place. There's a department here that's set up just for that, and I wanted to have the experience of working with people doing that, training with Dr. Alan Abbas, who runs the clinic of Center of Emotions and Health. So that was a great experience.
Wow, that is powerful. That's a broad resume that you have that is so powerful.
That's the short version.
Yeah, there's more. So the way that I found you, I feel is noteworthy because it lends to, I know that you grew up being an observer, and that you're just, it's hard to, if anybody who sees your website, which I will put in the show notes, will see how intentional, intuitive, and how powerful your knowledge is in being practical and helping people navigate, as you said, the very real things they're dealing with in a broad spectrum of somatic, what's coming up for them. And so I found you through a friend of mine who's one of your clients, clients. And she's one of my best friends, and she had a session with you. And apparently at the end of your sessions with your clients, you will often record a summary of what y'all discovered together for them to play back and be able to go through and process later. And she shared with me her, after her session with you, one of her sessions, but in this 5-minute clip that I listened to, I thought, oh my goodness, this is like summarizing 10 years of therapy in 5 minutes. Like, it was just so potent, so powerful in how it just walked through a process of understanding in this situation how to navigate big emotion that was coming up in a moment that there might be activation, and recognizing what was happening in her body and being able to then navigate that in real time, and how to do that, how to slow down enough to actually be able to go toward what was coming up for her. And I thought, I have to have him on the podcast to discuss this specifically. So I am so grateful that you responded and said yes, and that you're here with us today to discuss that.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome. And those recordings, I don't always do them, but like sometimes when a session for me is usually an hour or an hour and a half, and it is very process orientated of working through deeper material. Kind of like an inner journey, really, that we walk together and discover things. And the process of that brings up so much for each person that it's hard to remember. And there's something, what I call like an amnesia switch, based on a sci-fi book I read, the Fear Saga, and it talks about an AI system that can't remember parts of its programming. And so when we try and mess with ourselves, when we try and change, there's something in us that has like an amnesia switch. It switches off our ability to remember and hold those nuggets of truth. It's like as if something wants to just wipe it all clean, and we kind of go running circles. So these recordings can be very helpful to walk a person through, to remember, to revisit. I always suggest people do a bit of journaling afterwards as well. And sometimes deeper work can bring up memories and dreams as well, particularly within the first few days afterwards. And they're particularly of note. So,
right. Yeah. It's a powerful tool to have, because I can tell you the amount of times I've walked out of a session going, wait, what did we just discuss? I know she said something about this. And yeah, so that's powerful. Okay. So in that, you were talking about our tendency toward repression. So could you kind of give us an understanding of how we might recognize when we're facing, I mean, we're on a grief podcast where we're talking about not just grief, but any big emotion, how we might recognize the ways in which we will repress, or why we would even repress.
Yeah, so it's important to think about repression. It's part of our self-care system. The system is trying to regulate the body. And sadly, repression is the way people will recognize it, generally speaking, in the way they become quite negative in their mind. And they could become quite like deflated and feel quite like depressed, essentially. And you think about the word depressed as well, is something is being depressed, just like something is being repressed or suppressed. There's a system within us that holds down deeper feelings and deeper truths and memories, because it's basically the system has rightly or wrongly basically calibrated itself to go, and you can't handle this, I'll keep it down for you. And the repressive system tends to work like a bodyguard that remembers all the bad things that people have said to you and the way you've been treated, and then kind of repeats it back to you. And it kind of becomes a bully. So you'll hear things like, you're weak, you're no good, you're not good enough, you're a failure, you're a fake, all those kinds of things start to come up. And when a person, well, I say person, we, when we get into that thought process, it's crippling. And in many respects, that's what it's meant to do. It's meant to cripple our self-esteem so badly that we can't do anything, we don't say anything, and we don't get ourselves in trouble. It's just the way that our bodies do that. It's a little bit mean, but that's how desperate it is. So repression usually is a sign that somebody's outside their window of tolerance, i.e. their anxiety is too high to effectively feel feelings. Mm-hmm. But so when you're able to see that it's part of your self-care system, and you see that it's a bodyguard taking that bullying role, it's become a bit too kind of monstrous and a bit too overpowering. It helps to take a step back. And that's one of the most important things when we're experiencing repression, is the ability to spot it and take a step back and see, oh, that's my inner bodyguard doing its job. Like, that's my repressive system coming in. And when we can do that as a point of separation, without that, we can get really hooked into the negative ways of thinking. And they're very, very persuasive and very good at their job.
Yes. Okay. So I feel like for the practical purpose of being able for listeners to understand an example of this, I feel like I would happily share what I experienced in a situation, and then you can talk us through of what that looked like through that process. Sure. But last week with my kids, I had a rough day, but there was not just a rough day as in busy work, but something came up at work that activated something deeper within me. And that voice, that inner critic, that bully was coming online, and I could feel that. And I recognized it and could see this was happening, but I've got to go home and I need to make dinner and I want to connect with my kids, but that's there. And I'm like, okay, I can't really deal with that right now, but I went home and I started making dinner, and within about three of my kids were home. And I would say within about 16 and a half minutes. All mm-hmm. three of us were in tension. There was little, like, they had not had good days. We were not connecting, and not just not connecting, but there was some tension coming up. And I was getting really frustrated, even more so than I normally would, because of what I had dealt with prior, or what I hadn't dealt with that had come up at work. And so I started making the dinner, and I desperately wanted to sit down and eat with them, but I knew this was not going to get better. And what I needed most was I needed to have a moment to try to be with what was happening, but really I just wanted to escape. So internally, I knew this would be a good practice, but I wanted to just get out. I was done. I needed a break. So I said, here's the food. I'll be back. I'm going for a walk. So we have a state park. I have a state park by my house. And so I drove over there. I know what I need to do. I need to go for a walk. I need to walk this out, and eventually I'll access the feelings. But I actually don't want to do that. So I sit down on the bench, and I'm tense. I've got my arms folded, and I'm tapping my leg, and I'm just looking at this beautiful lake, and I'm like, this is dumb. This is dumb. How dare they? How dare these kids? And I'm in that anger, but I know it goes deeper than that. And there is a song that if I play it, it's instrumental. As soon as I play it, it will help crack open my heart, and I just soften and I can feel. And so what I knew needed to happen was I needed to get up, and there was this choice point while I'm sitting at the water. You can sit here and you can really stew, and we can be really angry, and that's warranted. The frustration was warranted. And also we could get up and we could start walking and work toward being back in back in my body. And so I got up, I put the song on, and as soon as the second note hits, I start crying because I start going through what that voice was telling me. And I'm crying that I'm feeling that way, that I see the bully. But then as I do, I get deeper. I go under the surface and I really start to grieve the conversation that I had, how it made me feel that I had at work. And also the grief that I felt as a mother, like, the how dare you leave your kids? Like, you have two nights a week that you have dinner and you can sit down, and this is one of them. And look at you, you're out here instead of being with your kids. And instead, it was just the grief of, this is hard. Being a mom is hard. I'm doing this solo, that, and just feeling all of that. So I sit down by the water and I just cry. And I just process through all of that it turns away from the bully to this compassionate being able to hold myself and be able to hold my experience and be able to, from that place, go, okay, now I know I have clarity. I know how I can move forward, go back in my home and create connection because I'm connected to myself, where before it was I'm not connecting to you, I'm not connecting to me, to slowly moving back into connection with myself. And so I saw the repression firsthand of that moment of that bullying, one, just for even feeling the way that I was feeling, and also being able to take the steps I needed. So what have you seen that comes up for us when we're repressing? How do we move that? How do we shift from we recognize we've got the bully and that's happening to being able to create the space of openness and feeling it?
Okay. Well, in actual fact, you kind of give a nice example of being able to do that. So, but I can pick up on some points and just elaborate a little bit more. So when you're coming, so you've got an incident and you could say it's upset your central nervous system, right? It's risen up. Feelings within you, and then you've got to get on with your household tasks of looking after the kids and cooking dinner. And meanwhile, these feelings are trying to come up to conscious awareness for you to process them through. And the way we hold feelings down is that it's through anxiety. There has to be some force that holds the feeling down. So your body will be carrying, like you were saying, it was carrying tension. So inside, like, yeah, this feeling saying, pay attention to me, and another part going, no, I've got jobs to do.
Right.
And when your body is in that state, you're going to be more in a kind of fight, flight, maybe even going into a freeze state. And so, like, when it is that people kind of get like angry with each other, it's kind of like the fight energy coming out. Like people like are more on edge. And sometimes we can call that anger, but it's kind of like more fight energy. We're trying to fight ourselves, fight other people away, fight for our space. And so like when we're in that place, we're holding a lot down. It's worth mentioning, this is how we get into a lot of arguments with other people. It's how we can fall out with other people. And it's not even their fault. We're just carrying stuff from the day or the week or whatever. And so of course, when we're anxious and we need to process something, we tend to want to go to somewhere and someone safe. That's our attachment. And you had made that decision that that place, this wasn't for your kids to process. This was for you and the park and a walk to process. So you did that very thing for yourself. You took yourself into that environment to feel, basically calm yourself. And usually we tend to go to other people because when we're around people that can help us understand, we can talk it through. There's just something about that that helps us calm. And we call that an empathic environment, that we reach another person that has the empathy for us in order to help us calm our central nervous system. And what you actually talked through there was you kind of doing that for yourself. But what was interfering with that process was basically your internal bodyguard. And I would tend to call it more like a bodyguard because although it's bullying and can seem like really mean, it's actually still part of our self-care system. And so it's best if we don't hate it. So if we can, because if we end up hating this anxious part of ourselves that's terrified that something awful is going to happen, we can end up getting more into the negativity and digging ourselves more into it. End up fighting that bodyguard when their job is just trying to protect us. And what we really need to be able to do is actually what you were saying you did is kind of separate and go, no, now I actually have time for these feelings. And something that internal network tends to do with repression, it tends to be quite harsh on us and judgmental on us. And it can often masquerade as guilt, you know, like you're saying about being a mother. I'm a bad mother and that kind of thing.
Number one, that's where I'm going to go. I'm a terrible mother.
Yeah. So it sounds like guilt, but really it's not guilt. It's self-punishment. Because healthy guilt is like, I'm sorry for causing harm. Right. But punishment is like just you can feel the difference and you feel the way your body reacts differently to it. So, you seem to have worked through a lot of the negativity, the kind of self-punishment masquerading as guilt that could have hooked you back in again. And then you're coming up to allowing feelings just to move. And once you're able to kind of relax, it's very interesting and to see what just emerges. And in psychotherapy, quite often, when a person just sits with their feelings emerging, they can often be very surprised at what comes up. It's not necessarily what you think it is.
And so
it's actually a process of having to let go of a sense of control, that you're trying to control what comes from your emotional space, rather than what you do have control over is how well you can be present, you can witness, you can be calm, and you can just invite whatever in up, and you need a safe place for that.
Right.
I probably could add lots to that, right? Like, but those are some main points from what your beautiful example there.
Well, I think I recalled in your recording that you said that I got to listen to that when we come up to the place where we can recognize that that internal bully or the guilt is there, that we congratulate it. Can you speak to that? Because that is so powerful and such a game changer.
Yeah. So in the recording, I spoke about when it was that when we recognize that internal voice saying, you know, saying those negative things and we're feeling down, we're feeling tired. So we've got the cognitive element of it, that essentially we've got the negative thoughts. And then quite often with repression, we tend to have the physical element too, feeling quite tired, down, depressed. It can often start with tension, but when it gets really bad, the body starts to deflate and you feel like you just want to curl up in a ball and just have no one near you. So once you're recognizing this system take over, to recognize that this is happening is a is a perspective shift. All of a sudden that you're kind of like stepped out and you're watching your body go through this process. So you're no longer in the repression. You can kind of watch it happen. And this is a beautiful thing for anyone to pick a hold of. And it's an achievement in itself. And the reason why it's so worth congratulating yourself is because quite often this system has a very good trap. That when you start to go, I'm being negative. What a stupid person I am. Oh, why have I done that again? Mm-hmm. So what happens is you notice the negativity with more negativity, and it gets you to think that you're out of it. But by allowing yourself to be negative about the negativity, you're actually still caught up in the loop. You haven't exited the repression whatsoever. You've just been hooked back into it. And so when you congratulate yourself, you're able to step back and go, I've noticed this system occurring. And the thing is, this is how it works. Like the repressive system, our anxiety kicks in quicker than we can think, which means you can't necessarily stop it happening. Your job isn't necessarily to stop it, but it's to notice when it's kicked in. And that's the thing, right? And then
that's
you can
a game changer. Like, I just want to say that again, because I cannot overemphasize how powerful that is. Our job isn't to stop the repression. It's just to recognize when it's happening. And that in and of itself is major transformation.
Yeah. And what's even nicer at this point, once you start to kind of be able to say, oh, I'm repressing something, I'm calling myself weak here, or I'm being hard on myself, this is actually an opportunity to delve deeper. Your repression system that's trying to push something down is trying to push something down, which you can choose to be curious about. So every time that you get anxious or negative, you can go, oh, what you're pushing down. So you can start to almost be curious in the face of struggling. And when you're curious, it's very different from being anxious. Anxiety wants us to avoid. Curiosity is an approach emotion. So we're learning to approach ourselves rather than be frightened and avoid ourselves. Because essentially, repression is showing that your body is in conflict with itself, and it needs your help to resolve it. Mm. It's in a pattern, and that's what psychotherapy tends to do. It helps to interrupt an ingrained automatic pattern that we can't help, and gets us to notice, stand back, and then intervene in a different way.
Okay, so you have that point where you go, okay, I recognize I'm doing it. What are the practices that you recommend for gently, lovingly bringing us to the emotion of what we're now curious, what's coming up? What are we going to see happen typically?
Well, unhooking yourself from a repressive process and the negativity can be hard in itself. So it's worth just allowing some space for that. That when I see people in this state, this is, like I said, it's like it can be outside the window of tolerance. So I can see people really, really end up in quite a state here. Like they can go really downhill. So so there's something about to be said about having a relationship with that kind of inner bodyguard, as I call it, that you're learning to separate, to see it, to stand, to kind of like basically say, look, you don't need to be in control of me anymore. I can do this. I'm willing to take care of the feelings that you're pushing down within me. So there is something about spending a time with that, just to mention straight off, because sometimes when we do psychotherapy, it's all about getting to deep feelings. But really, it's actually about how we meet each part of ourselves, and meeting our repressive system and our anxiety and our negativity is just as important that we meet that with care and love as our own deeper feelings. Mm. So if you're able to like allow that, you're able to kind of get the repressive system, your bodyguard, to kind of sit it out, and you're more observant. There's a couple of things that may happen. Sometimes emotions will just surge right up. They'll just come up, and sometimes you won't even know what they're about. So you might find that you get sad or angry or feel guilty, and it just comes boiling up. And then in some respects, if it starts to just flow, you'll tend to feel a bit better from it. It would feel strong. It can feel intense, but quite often it feels kind of like cathartic. And what can happen is if you just stay with the energy and it can flow, quite often thoughts, memories, moments will come to mind. And this is kind of like your emotions speaking to you. So like, and then you can kind of go on a bit of a journey with that. What quite often happens is that when strong emotions come up, you might get blips of emotion, and then your body will get defensive again, and then it will try and pack it down. So it's not just like, oh, it's not like as if the door just opens and it's all there. It is for some people, but right. more often it opens and then it closes. Opens and then it closes. And quite often is because the more you listen to yourself, the situation kind of gets complicated. One motion can get more intense. It can lead to another. It starts to lead to some memories. You start to go over those memories, and then it gets kind of complicated. You get a bit stuck. And so this is the other end. Sometimes when you're allowing yourself just to feel things, the situation might come with a bit more clarity. So I'd often explore what the triggering event is. What is it about that thing that has bothered somebody? And that's another exploration point. And typically for people in the trigger, it's a trigger because it's related to other things in their life. It's a it's like a primal wound, like a sensitive wound that someone's pressed on. Rarely do things massively upset us that aren't linked to some kind of past event. You know, we have sensitivities, most of us do. Learning those patterns within ourselves is important too.
And when you see people in front of you that are navigating this process, what are some of the things that they resist? What are some things, the resistance that they initially feel? I know safety would be one, to feel safe with themselves and to be able to feel what's coming up. But what are some of the things that they might have to acknowledge as they're beginning this process and this kind of work?
Yeah. So repression in itself tends to come up because these negative thoughts tend to come up when we have strong emotions. So they show kind of like a threshold of where your body says, this emotion coming up, being present in my conscious, being in my environment, at a certain point, it's not okay. So my body has to push it down. And typically, the way our body pushes it down and gets negative over these things, that tends to be learned from our history. So if we have people in our lives that are very accommodating and are like very open and able to share some space, and so as a child or a young person, there's lots of space for that, and it's all good, then emotions are free to kind of come up and flow. But more often than not, these emotions are inconvenience to the people around us. And we get this kind of, whether we're told outright or not, we get told to be quiet. And that's how essentially repression starts to kick in. We start to learn the limits of what's acceptable and what's not. And so when we're having strong feelings, if it's kind of above that threshold that we've been taught in life that's okay, not okay to express, then our body naturally pushes it down. And we don't even need anyone else to be around. Our body just naturally starts to limit itself around there. And so quite often in therapy, when strong emotions come up, people will relive that with me. They will kind of like, they won't feel safe with me because their body doesn't feel safe with me, because that the pattern it's learned is it's not safe to let this much emotion come up with a person. Mm-hmm. And so that will come up in me. So as therapy, it comes through in what we call transference, right? They transfer past examples of being shut down, judged, even hurt, even horrible things happen to them. And the fear system transfers it onto the person in front. It happens to be me. And then sometimes people can get afraid of me and they start to limit themselves. And you might find this with someone who's close to you, a partner or a friend, that you'll find yourself getting frightened of telling someone something. You know, it's like a limit. And the idea of building trust in a relationship is how well two people can negotiate that emotional limit together. And so there's something to be said about when the floodgates open, people start to shut down, and we need to work through what's okay to express in the room. And sometimes that's more intense emotions, or emotions that are basically what we call in the shadow, which means they've been shown that these emotions aren't okay, that they're bad. So anything in the shadow is basically, yeah, it's material that other people have labeled as inconvenient or bad, or it's hurt them. And so we go, we're not allowed to go there. And so as that material comes up, the body tends to, again, hold itself down. And it's working through that. And that's what you do, probably do good relationships. You work through these moments.
Right. Well, but, and I want to touch back on when you said, though, that we can even do that repression completely alone. We could be, I could sit there at the lake and have this moment where I'm in an environment where I would normally feel safe. And I've got the body language of, I am shut down. I am not willing to open up even to myself. And so it's almost like this, you know, we can only go so deep with others as we've gone with ourselves. And so like that practice of learning, we have to take that invitation. I have to take that invitation to meet myself that way so that it can become easier when I do trust someone, if I am in front of somebody who I know is safe, to be able to then practice that kind of openness and vulnerability. But I think that's fascinating because I've seen that where even just by myself, I can refuse to feel anything and push that down.
Yeah. Yeah. And so it's kind of, you can do the work both ways around. So like you can feel more, be with yourself, let that come up, and then you're more capable, hopefully, of sharing that with others. Mm-hmm. But there's also something about, you know, the way our anxiety works, we go somewhere and to someone safe, and that's tends to what happened in therapy. So sometimes because we've been hurt in relationships, we've learned to hold ourselves down. The healing really needs to happen in relationships. There's a sense of, you know, how well can the body trust in humanity again, that there are people that are capable of hearing this, being with this. Mm-hmm. And then hopefully, and then when you have those experiences, equally, when you're on your own, you remember those times and you go, no, it is okay that I have these feelings, that we kind of, allow more space for ourselves. It expands over time.
Mm. So I want to ask about the somatic aspect. So you're able to identify repression by being able to pay attention to the cues in your body and then being able to meet those compassionately. Can you give an example of the way that that you would make that shift, or how somatically, what are the practices that you're giving yourself to for your body in that moment, not just intellectualizing what's happening, but in your body?
So it's important to, when your body's scanning yourself, to see how your body is essentially constricting on itself or inhibiting emotions. There tends to be different ways the body does that. The first way is it creates tension. So in your voluntary muscles, you'll get tense. You'll notice a lot of people get tense around their neck and their shoulders and their back. And a lot of the time it's unconscious. They won't even know they're doing it. And so so when we're holding emotions down and we've got like tightness there, it's like, oh, it just kind of like, we won't even be aware that our body is holding this down. And you can see somatically, this is where things like chronic fatigue come from and chronic pain, because the body is doing a workout all day by inhibiting emotions through tension. Mm. And tension is what we usually, you know, you could think about that as kind of fight or flight. So in the voluntary muscles, your body wants to do something with it. And regulating that can be as simple as noticing, breathing into it, kind of maybe stretching a little bit, just to loosen off, consciously relaxing, consciously giving permission for emotions to rise. When we're suppressing and over with tension, what normally comes with that is overthinking. We tend to be in our heads a lot. And the more we're thinking in our heads, the less we're in our bodies. So in a way, it's about kind of less thinking and more noticing. Now, that isn't necessarily repression in itself. That's more suppression. Now, when the body gets more, when it struggles more, what happens is it can't quite hold the tension in the voluntary muscles anymore. And what happens is that it kind of goes more into your organs, what's called your smooth muscle anxiety system. And that's where more your kind of parasympathetic nervous system, you tend to get more kind of deflated and flat. This is where you can start to have symptoms like stomach upset, nausea, acid reflux, more likely to get like migraines. Sometimes people get skin flares up. They can start to feel a little bit kind of like weak and floppy in their body and get really, really tired. And basically this is the body shutting down. And so in that, so that approach, somatically looking after that, requires a different approach. It isn't necessarily about trying to relax more. It's actually about trying to bring more tension into the body. So like moving, when stretching, you're not trying to relax, you're actually pushing blood back into your voluntary muscles. You want it to go back in there again. So it's a different approach depending on what kind of anxiety is going on. And then, you know, in some cases it can get even worse. And what, when it goes even worse, you sometimes you'll get, it will go into your perceptual system. So your eyes can get blurry, ears can start to ring, you can over salivate, you start to lose voluntary control over your muscles. You can get like really, really weak and wobbly legs. People can feel like they're fainting. They can get very paranoid and afraid in these moments. The body just starts to just switch itself off. So it's kind of going into a place of shock. And that's like what severe anxiety can look like. So again, and that takes a different approach. You know, a lot more keeping away from any triggers, a lot more movement, a lot more talking through what's happening with a person. You know, so and this is where like when I did my when you look into health conditions and things like this, these things can look like strokes. Like, oh, like you feel like you've got dementia, or like, and your body is just really, really struggling. And so they can be very, they can offer it in a way, a bit of a feedback loop, because you think that something like really big health concerns happening, which makes a person panic even more, and it just can spin really out of control. So, so when you think about anxiety, it has quite a broad spectrum of how severe it can get. And that's why psychotherapy can take some time, because sometimes when you start to approach deeper emotions, your body can start to enter deeper states of anxiety. And that's why it's actually important to back off sometimes and regulate.
Right. No, it is like there's four rabbit holes we could just go down right there. Yeah. But it's like I can't help but think of the analogy of, you know, when we were kids in school, if there was a big test, we knew, I mean, that we would have a somatic response to the anxiety. We would have a stomach ache or get sick, or I don't want to go to school today and fake a temperature. You know, like these are the connection between the brain body of this event, where what we really needed in that moment was a conversation around what was coming up for us about that test, or how we might, what we might need. Did we need more preparation? Did we need some encouragement? Like, and as adults, we go through our daily lives, one, not recognizing how our bodies are even being impacted, and treating symptoms without getting under the surface. So when people, by the time they come to you, they're coming because of, they know they've got an issue that's happening, a recurring issue, and then you're uncovering the roots of that, or is it reversed, or is it both?
It depends. So more so in when I work for the health authority, a lot of people were told to come to me rather than necessarily wanting to. and so they were often skeptical about whether their stomach ache, their blurry eyes, their confusion, their chronic fatigue, or whatever it was connected to a psychological process. They were just doing due diligence and going to what the doctor said. So one of the first things that needs to happen there is for a person to get to, we actually need to test that out. And the worst thing that can happen is that we call something anxiety when it's a health problem. And the other way around, for you to think it's a health problem when it's actually an emotional thing. And so, and there's an interrelationship between the two. And so as part of an assessment, it is important that we assess rather than assume things. And so what you can do is, given that emotional incidents tend to cause the body stress, one thing you can do is, as you talk about or experience emotionally charged situations, look what your body does. And that's kind of what therapy does. You look at a baseline, how anxious are you? Okay, let's talk about this thing. Let's see what happens. Oh, you're getting stomach ache. We help to regulate, come back. Do you want to do it again? Yeah. And it's kind of like, and then it's like, oh, it's not just coincidence. Look what happens. We talk about this particular incident and your legs go wobbly. You want to go to the toilet really quickly. And so what happens is a person starts to, you're not really telling them, you're showing them through their own experience what's happening. And that's really, really important because you can't just tell people. They need to have an experience of it. And nor do I ever want to be in the situation where I'm just assuming that. It's a very dangerous thing to do, you know, to miss a health condition that's going on at the same time.
Yeah, absolutely. What do you think has been the most surprising for you that you've learned about that connection since you started doing this work with people?
Oh, there is something in us. I don't know what you, different approaches have different names. Some you can call it like there's some kind of, you know, spirit, inner healer. It's called a UTA in psychodynamics, which is a kind of unconscious therapeutic alliance. There's some kind of healing force within us that just actually wants to help us heal. And once we're able to kind of like listen to our bodies, it's really, really surprising and continues to be surprising and amazing at what comes up for people. Mm-hmm. And in many respects, our symptoms are that voice. That when we get symptoms and we're struggling with anxiety, low mood, and all sorts of things, it's our bodies saying, I need some help from you. Can you help me? Can you see what's causing this? Get to the root of what's underneath the symptoms. You know, why is it that I'm getting all tensed and negative on myself? What is it my body's fighting against? And there is essentially an inner voice there you can listen to. And to a lot of people that can be very skeptical over that. But you just think when we cut ourselves, our body heals. We don't have to think about it.
Right.
And the mind's the same. The mind wants to be at peace. The mind wants to be healthy. And, you know, this is the interesting thing is that when sometimes you get like flashbacks, nightmares, intrusive thoughts, difficult moments ruminating around your mind's basically saying, I need you to sort this out with me.
Mm.
Like, so it's an invitation. But quite often what happens is it frightens us so much that we want to avoid it. And then this avoidance keeps this constant cycle of not being able to process something. And in all fairness, sometimes these events that we need to process are horrendous. And we need a lot of help to be able to do that and a lot of time. And that's hopefully what therapy does. The relationship shares is showing a person it's a safe and secure place to be able to do this together.
Mm. I love that. So you've seen it, I'm sure, time and time again, which actually I would assume motivates you to keep doing the work is the healing that is possible.
Oh yeah. And through the empathy with the work that I've learned so many different approaches at this point in my career now that one thing that I will tend to go by more than anything else after all the kind of work I've done on myself and with people is the kind of connection I have with someone else. And you can use that as a guide. So, and you can use that with yourself and other people too. It's like, how much am I kind of leaning into this conversation? How much am I leaning back from it? Like, so you can kind of gauge a sense of involvement. And quite often for therapists that work a long time with emotions and things, like you can feel the emotions coming up from someone else in the room, even before they talk about them. And a lot of people have this experience, and we call it empathy, right? You know, when someone's in a bit of a bad mood or struggling with an emotion, even if they're not saying it, we tend to be able to pick up on those things. And in the therapeutic space, there can be emotions just calling for the attention of two people to notice them. So it's kind of like an invitation that hopefully we can both take up.
Yeah, I love that. So are there any myths or things that you would want to, how would I word this, misconceptions that you would say you've noticed about this work that you would want others to know?
I'm sure there are many. quite often that voice that we call repression, the negativity, will often hook people in. There'll be phrases like, I don't want to feel my sadness. It will drive me crazy. I'll cry forever. So if you think about that, what happens is the thought comes up and then the person's like, kind of gets convinced that that's true. And then will turn against their body. And so what of course you need to get hold of is that bodyguard is just doing a very good job of hooking you in. And right. so It's how well you can learn to trust your own body, that if you feel a very natural emotion, which we've been feeling since birth, right? Because kids communicate through feelings first. They learn to think and speak a lot later on, that right. Our bodies know exactly how to process feelings. So we just learn to trust in that. And healthy emotions, they come up, they tell us things, and then they subside. That's what they do. And they'll keep on coming up in waves until the day we die. And a misconception that I often will say to people is that I'll hear, I just want to get rid of this feeling. Mm. And so the whole process of really about inner development isn't getting rid of any feeling whatsoever. It's owning it. Can you own the feeling? Can you look after it? And if you can look after your sadness or your anger or whatever is inside you, your body doesn't need to be anxious over it anymore. Your body doesn't need to automatically hold it down. Because if you think about it, your body is not trusting you to look after it. So it'll hold it down out of your awareness. So so it's about like a deeper and deeper layers of trusting in yourself.
I love that. That is so powerful because I have so many practical examples of that in my own life that I can attest to the power of owning it, being able to face it to create the safety and the nervous system capacity to be able to do that, to give permission for that. Okay, so I want to ask, what are you learning or unlearning right now about this work that's alive for you?
Maybe that ties into something I could say along with this about what love looks like. Because I've had like these epiphanies like year after year about, I kind of understand what love looks like therapeutically, you know, to be non-judgmental and what have you. And like, you can say these things, but there are moments where you go, that has dropped away. The judgment has dropped away and I just feel really patient with somebody. But there's something about like, the way I like to think about love as a developmental line is how well we can stay with suffering without turning our back on it. Because that, quite often when it comes to trauma, that's what our body is asking us to do. Can you stay with me? And so there's something about that and the exploration of that within me as a person of just how well I can stay with the suffering in individuals, in myself and in the world, and still stay present. And at the same time, in that, I'm quite a sensitive individual when it comes to picking up emotions and things with people, and how overwhelming that can be to have that light up in me all the time. And so on one level, it's kind of like, it's like a gift, but I didn't quite realize how exhausting it could be. So right. In many respects, I'm learning the difference between relaxation and actual rest. What does rest for my body and my brain look like? And so I'm learning that, you know, to look after myself, that ways of being, you know, as a Enneagram number 5, where I'm very intellectual and I can push, that doesn't necessarily serve me as well as it used to. And the other thing to mention about this pushing thing is that quite often when we get negative on ourselves with repression, there is an invitation to get out. And the invitation in CBT language, repression is often thought about as negative core beliefs. You know, I'm bad, I'm this, I'm that. And then what we have is a conditional belief that says, well, if you're good enough, if you're perfect, if you try harder, if you succeed, and basically you'll be loved enough, you'll be, you know, accepted enough. And so there's this invitation to kind of push into these things and achieve and be perfect and all that kind of thing. And sadly, a lot of that energy is anxious energy. I'm learning to, you know, pull the finer threads of what is real passion and curiosity and interest, and what are the older elements still in me that wants to, you know, needs to be perfect, needs to succeed, needs to do all these things that have helped me go from no education to undergraduate to a doctorate. And then, you know what I mean? It's like this, right. there's parts of that survival personality that the threads in there are really deep. So like learning to identify and uncover that. And so, and here's the other thing is sometimes as I learn to understand myself more, love more, I've been going back to old memories that I thought I put to bed. I thought I'm done with, but I can see them from a new light. I'm like, I see this old stuff, these old traumas, and I can even add a whole new level of insight and care to them that I didn't see before. So there's something about, like, a lot of people will say to me, but we've gone over this. But it's like, well, what did we miss the first time? And this is the thing, going back to basics, going back to these things again and again and again will add insight. What you see at age 20 for your five-year-old self's trauma would be different to your 30-year-old self, 40-year-old self, 50-year-old self. The hope is if you carry on learning, you look with more and more empathy, and the more you have that towards yourself, the more you'll have that in the world.
Right.
And this is the struggle. This is often another side of the coin is the more you learn to love and understand, it can feel quite threatening. It's because you'll start to uncover things in your own history and in the world that bother you more. And that's a hard thing. So in some respects, like ignorance is kind of bliss in that, right? If you don't you don't feel things, it's easier to make decisions. So in some respects, the more you know, the more you feel, the more sensitive you are to the world.
Can you give an example of that? I know that's a on the spot thing. Could you tell how that might, what's an example of that? Things that used to not bother you, now they bother you.
Well, for example, my workload. I used to have to, when I worked for the health authority, one of the reasons I left was because I had to see 4 or 5 people a day, 5 days a week. And I could do that, and I enjoyed my job. And then there was a point where I wasn't enjoying it anymore. And I had to kind of like, and I thought, oh, I need to just improve. I need to get better. I need to like, need to do more, what have you. But then there's some point I go, do you know, maybe this isn't, I need to actually listen to my body. What's good for my own body? And so the shift was moving from this achieving mindset to actually being in service of my own body. Not even kind of like, well, it's interesting when we think about who am I, what is myself. You know, I'm traveling around in my body. My body is it's of service to me, and I'm of service to it. It is me, but it's not me. And it's kind of like there's been a shift where I'm having to really start to learn about like what works for me and what doesn't actually.
Right.
And what's really nice is my body and my emotions will tell me when I feel hurt or sad or exhausted, how well am I able to, again, listen to that? There's health in that.
Mm.
So sometimes when we get like really down on ourselves and negative, that's also a sign of burnout and exhaustion.
Right.
So sometimes you can go digging for problems when actually the way you've constructed your life is just not good for you. It's burning you out. It's too much for your central nervous system. And anyone that's got like anything that's, more neurodivergent, on ADHD, autism, things like that, they'll know about this because they get burnt out on a whole different level quicker that needs to be recognized. And it doesn't necessarily point to a mental health problem. It's pointing to the way the body needs to be dealt with differently in a more loving way. So a more inclusive way. So I'm becoming more and more inclusive nowadays, I suppose. And I'm wondering about how, for example, body work comes more into psychotherapy and more and more spiritual aspects too as well. I mean, psychology in itself is kind of like it's the study of the soul, as it were. And quite often through its academic roots, it loses touch with that. So, re kind of orientating towards what it really means.
I love that. Like I said, if you go to your website, you see the impact of how deeply integrated soul and body is in the work that you do. And so I think that's really, really powerful. Is there anything that you would want to leave us with that to kind of summarize, or that you feel, hey, it's important to note this, I want to make sure the listeners have?
Oh, honestly, there could be so much I could say here. But I mean, I think there's something about this whole idea about self-development that needs to be understood in terms of, you know, when we ask ourselves, what is self-development? And it's kind of a nebulous kind of concept often at the time. And so there's ways that we can think about, like, well, what does that mean to me? And sometimes it might mean that that when we start to get anxious and avoid a conversation, that we get anxious and then have the conversation. That's mm-hmm. development. And so sometimes it's when we start to find our blocks, like, or when we get kind of caught up in something, is what does something forward look like? Maybe like it can look as something like, oh, I got caught up in my depression and negative thinking for X amount of days, and now I reduced it to a day shorter, or maybe even I noticed it like in an hour or whatever it is. So there's just this sense of like, what is my aim to shift? And so it's sometimes kind of nice in those summaries that I give at the end of a session, it's just to think about, how do you apply this stuff to everyday life? Right. You know, like, so if you weren't so shut down in survival place, shutting yourself down, what does it look like to kind of live a bit more of an expanded life, to be a bit more free? What does that really look like? My brain's gone a little bit mad with the amount of things I could say here.
Keep going. You
well, the thing is, the other difficult thing for a lot of us is, I kind of pulled on it before, is sometimes that the things that we do that we think are helpful for ourselves are most damaging. Mm. And we have to kind of learn the lesson, like this achievement thing, like, for example, like, there's this hustle culture and what have you, and this achieving, making more money, being more successful. And in itself, it's not that any of that stuff is inherently bad. We need to be able to feel successful and have a sense of status and be able to stand up in the world and be able to feel like, right, you know, an individual. We need to build a sense of an ego that can do things and achieve things. But there's a point at which we recognize that when we do that, it can come at a cost. Mm. And so it's worth recognizing that when I push, it has a cost. And then how well can I keep on achieving, but pay attention to the cost that it causes as well? And that then you're kind of starting to not only like get hold of like what's good in the world for you and your family and the world and what have you. And in some respects, that's the test, right? It's not just about us anymore. It's not just about our families. It goes beyond our community. It goes beyond our country. And it comes global. If you want to go even further, it becomes universal, whatever you want to call it. Right? There's something that it expands always. And so how well can my achievement have bigger and bigger goals that aren't just egotistical, aren't just ethnocentric, aren't just about the group, aren't just about the country. They're about something bigger and more fundamental, about helping us all move through, a cycle of evolution in our own consciousness. We can often get kind of like stuck, and it's worth questioning, if I keep on doing it this way, is this really good for me in the world? Where does it go next? And quite often symptoms will show us. Often symptoms that show up in the room that the people come to me is because the way a person's living their life is essentially causing them ill health. And their symptoms are the lifeline that says, you need to do something different.
Right.
And the way you're doing it right now isn't going to work. This is how you got yourself in a mess. You need a new way of being. So again, it's about like, in some respects, allowing yourself to relieve that comfort zone and expand into something new. And that's why people come to psychotherapy, right? And they listen to podcasts like this, because we need different perspectives.
Right.
So conversations like this are, important.
Yeah.
So
Yes. Thank you for having them. These were the conversations that helped shift my perspective, that helped me to recognize the patterns that were just keeping me in the loop. And I think of not just, you're mentioning the way that we recognize it in our bodies, but like our relationships can be the tell for us of what's not working. the patterns we have in relationships, and being able to disrupt those because they're not working anymore and something needs to shift. But it's going to require us to go into this work in a deep and profound way.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Thank you so much for being here and for having this conversation with me. I'm hopeful that I can have this again.
Sure.
We have like 10 different, you know, rabbit trails we could go on, but I really enjoyed this. So
absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
And where can people find you? I'm going to have the website, but if they, that.
Yeah. It's just drrickybarrows.com. And I'm licensed in Nova Scotia, Canada to treat people. Sometimes I'll see people from other parts of the world as well. Sadly, a lot of North America has its own, each province and state has its own rules, which is quite limiting. That's where I'm at.
And so we talk you into getting a podcast so we can hear you regularly. That's what we'll have to do.
Oh, maybe this will inspire me.
Yes. Well, thank you for being here. Everybody, thank you for listening. And I hope that where you are, you're having a great day. And we'll talk to you next time.